Welcome to this week's Reaction podcast. I'm joined by Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and Maggie Pagano, our executive editor. If you like what you hear, please do subscribe to us on our website, which you can find at www.reaction.life. I realise that this is the first podcast with the whole kind of podcast team for a while, but we've had some technical difficulties, but hopefully you'll enjoy what we have to talk about today. We've got the budget, we've got Harry and Meghan, and the Oprah interview that's set to air on Monday, I think, in America at any rate. And we're also going to talk a bit about the Salmon Sturgeon affair and our various takes on that. So Ian, can you kick us off about the Sturgeon's Sturgeon's evidence this week at the inquiry and your thoughts on it?
Yeah, thank you, Alistair. It's extraordinary week in Scottish politics, and I was trying to explain this to someone from a London person and trying to explain what this meant politically, and was trying to explain it as the unravelling of something that's been going on for 25 years, that Salmon and Sturgeon are part of the same small, now very big, but run by a small group of people, the same political project that's been running since the early to mid-90s, that this is the equivalent of the group that formed around Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and New Labour in 94-95, still being the big story, and one of them still wielding extraordinary power and running the country, and all of their principals and aides being in court, fighting with each other and slagging each other off in parliamentary committees. That's how long this group around Salmon and Sturgeon have been in business. And I can remember I was there as a young political reporter in Scotland for the Sunday Times in the mid 90s, and knew a lot of them very well, and saw that form when the SNP was really still a kind of faction and regarded as a bit of a joke by Scottish Labour, feared in certain respects when it came to by-elections, but it wasn't really deemed conceivable that the Nationalists would form government. And of course, the Scottish devolution system was designed on the assumption that some form of kind of rainbow coalition, Labour, the Liberals, maybe some Greens, would govern forever, and that the SNP would never be able to get a majority. And then the system turned out by a series of historic accidents to deliver the SNP in power from 2007. So to me, it's just been quite something watching all of that unravel and play out. I think, will she survive? I'm very bad at working out whether politicians are about to resign or not. I think I do think she's in extremely serious trouble, and there's a chance she might have to go. She does seem to have misled Parliament. The question of has she broken the ministerial code, I think, could end up being central to it. And voters say in the most recent opinion polls that they do, for all that they like Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland, they do take that seriously. So her future hangs in the balance after those 7-8 hours of evidence that she gave Maggie.
It was 8 hours.
Yeah. What did you make of it?
Well, I have to say, I have found myself utterly, utterly beguiled and gripped by this story. And I'll be totally honest, Ian, until a reaction started, I've never really followed Scottish politics in that way. And it's taken knowing you and Alistair, you know, you have first-hand experience, to really get into it. And what I absolutely really appreciate and respect about what's happening now is that even though you've clearly had this one party state for the last 10 years and this formidable grip, and she's a formidable politician, you have to hand her that, is that, as you use the word, unravelling, but it's unravelling because there is a democratic system, because we have institutions and we have the press. And I think what it shows so dynamically is that, you know, we're not in East Germany. These things, if you keep up the pressure, they do come apart. I know the committee system has been much criticised, hasn't it? And there's some fairly weak politicians there, but, you know, Jackie Bailey from Labour and Murdo Fraser. I just thought, you know, and under pressure yesterday, even though I said she was amazing in with her stamina yesterday, she reminds me of the black swan at the end of Swan Lake, you know, that rather desperate flapping around underneath this big sort of helmet of hair. I can just, that's how I see her. She is the black swan. Go and watch it. And it might not be this that trips her up, but I think at the end is there, the denouement. It might be something else that now crops up that finishes her off. But her persona has been damaged. I think a lot of a spotlight has gone in on her policies, such as education, the drug taking, you know, all the issues in Scottish politics that you hear about that haven't really been addressed and have become secondary to her rule, haven't they? But actually, that's the dynamic that will really get rid of her. And also the propaganda on independence. We haven't even talked about independence. I think people are seeing through that.
It's interesting. We'll talk. That's a very quite different perspective to mine, Maggie. Really interesting, because I've been really depressed is the wrong word, but quite engaged and really fired up about what's wrong with Scottish democracy. Living in London, people will say, "Well, what's it got to do with me?" But I'm Scottish. To me, this entire scandal and the difficulties that the committee have had in getting to the truth in terms of getting the evidence that they want, and the blurring, as Alex Salmond put it, I thought rather brilliantly, the blurring of lines of accountability between the Crown Office, the prosecutor, the Office of the First Minister, the senior civil service, and Parliament, and party power. All of that suggests to me that Scottish democracy is built, the devolution settlement is built on something which is very poorly designed. I will come back to that in a moment. I can explain why I think that happened and what Dewar and the other founding fathers and mothers of devolution thought that they were doing. But ultimately, they've created a system which is not good enough at holding the executive to account. To me, what's required is reform of the Scottish system to make the Parliament, and this is going to sound odd coming from someone who is a unionist who is sceptical about devolution, but it's there, it exists, so I would make the Parliament much more powerful. I don't mean in terms of independence, I just mean in terms of democratic accountability. And, I think back to the arguments that I had with some of my friends who were senior in the SNP or people I knew in Scottish Labour at the time, and this was a point made by quite a lot of prominent Tories at the time, but no, very few people were listening. The idea was that this was supposed to be, because it would have a sort of Belgian-style hemisphere, chamber, unicameral, a nice system with PR, different from ghastly Westminster, that it would automatically just be nicer and more Scottish and upstanding. And what is revealed by the events of the last, by this scandal, is that's simply not the case. And there's something wrong with the basic democratic wiring of the thing. The Parliament is not powerful enough yet to hold the executive to account. What's your perspective, Alistair, watching it from London, but obviously having seen it develop in Scotland as well?
Well, you're right. And there's a particular issue that you could start off with in terms of reforming Holyrood. I mean, why is there no such thing as parliamentary privilege in Holyrood? It just seems like a first thing to get right. I think even the First Minister said that there was in her evidence at one point said that potentially, I mean, raised the issue, or the issue was raised, and it is absurd that basically Holyrood is treated like any other publisher. In the eyes of the law, Holyrood isn't so different from the Spectator magazine in terms of how they're, you know, maybe I'm wrong about that and I'm getting the legal stuff wrong, but it does seem like something which should happen. I mean, from a personal perspective, you know, I'm, what, 26 years old, and I grew up in Edinburgh, and I was, some of my earliest memories as a child were going into school, picking Donald Dewar as the politician, you know, in the show and look days, you know, when I was eight, picking Donald Dewar as the politician that I did a little picture of and description of, you know, with that quote, "There shall be a Scottish Parliament." And it was a very proud thing for me growing up to think that we have now, we didn't have a parliament for years and years, and now we do. My father's a civil servant who was working in the, what was then the Scottish Executive. You know, the whole thing growing up made me very, very proud. Looking at it now and looking at the institutions, the pathos of the kind of high-mindedness that you mentioned, Ian, the atmosphere that surrounded devolution, the kind of Donald Dewar speeches, you know, McCormack, the son of King John, the sort of scion of nationalism, talking about how we were in Scotland embarking on an experiment where we would, you know, supplant new unions for old and heal the old divisions, and Scotland's new devolution settlement would be a sort of experiment in a post-sovereign Europe where different forms of democracy would play out between these different sort of venues, between Westminster, between Strasbourg and Edinburgh. Yeah. All that feels very, very long ago. And yeah, there's a lot of pathos there, I think, because you just look at the system, the way the committees have been, the way the evidence has been presented, the way also seeing Salmon and Sturgeon, you know, sort of just the way things seem to be run and the kind of atmosphere, it makes me pretty gutted. And I felt actually very ashamed to be Scottish over the last week, not just because of some of Sturgeon's, the way she's handled it, but also the way Salmon clearly treated his employees very badly over time. And that was, you know, clearly it happened over a long, long period. But
I mean, I felt angry about it, but it was predictable and predicted. I mean, this democratic shortfall or shortcoming. And thinking back to that period, it was a very, very intense period. I was then a political journalist, political editor, I think, of Scotland on Sunday. So tracked it all pretty closely. My dear friend Alan Cochrane, who I think was deputy editor of that newspaper then, used to say to me, I think half in jest, you've just got to get into the mood of the new Scotland. But you would say, you know, just to prod me, because I was an anti-devolutionist, or I was a bit sore about devolution. And I was there that day Dewar made that speech and the opening, you know, well, yes, it was moving, and Concord flew down Prince's Street and there was a lot of optimism. My concern was, and I'm not saying I was right, because, you know, maybe in the long run, my concerns about devolution and those of us who were anti-devolution just need to accept that something was happening in a 50, 60 year process, that the UK was too centralized and there was clearly a demand for it, and political identity was changing, so something like devolution had to happen. But my argument was always, if you have the thing, you have to take its design and its construction really seriously. I think, weirdly, they weren't grandiose enough about it. I remember arguing with them, saying, think of yourselves in the way that the founding fathers did in the US. You could have really serious debates about what is tyranny. How can it be constrained? Which powers do you want the executive to have? Which powers do you want the parliament to retain? Now, one of the reasons the parliament was designed in the way it was that not only did Dewar think, and those around him think, there would probably be a sort of permanent anti-nationalist coalition in power, they also wanted it to retain its power, or to have limited power, and Westminster to retain its power as a sovereign parliament, for understandable reasons. It's within a UK union setup, but that meant that whoever drafted the legislation was very keen to ensure that the committees didn't have too much power. They didn't have full parliamentary privilege in the way that Westminster did. They have something called qualified privilege, which I think covers defamation, but not contempt. What that leads to, and this has got to be fixed, this has to be fixed, and Westminster could fix it in a fortnight, and it should do it in consultation with the next Scottish government at Holyrood, is that the parliamentary committees need to be given the full power of the parliament, as happens at Westminster. You cannot have a situation in which the Crown Office can effectively order Parliament around. And this is the stuff, people kind of laughed at this at the time about when devolution was being formed. Just said, oh, don't worry about it because things will just be nicer because we're Scottish. Is that this is the stuff that in English history and American history and all sorts of countries was grappled with for decades. And maybe this is just part of, this is a sort of decades long thing which is going to need fixed, and maybe it will take 20 or 30 years to fix it. But that they were dealing, you know, in the English Revolution and what followed, with fundamental questions of how do you restrain the crown? How do you ensure that Parliament is sovereign, that the monarch is sovereign only in Parliament? It's not pretentious or grandiose to talk about it. These are the philosophical. This is the philosophical stuff you have to grapple with to get to safety checks, separation of powers, and ensuring that Parliament, that the executive answers to Parliament and not the other way around.
Is there a sort of more positive spin? The way I look at it is this Scottish Parliament is very, very young. It's bound to have faults and flaws, because you can't design the most perfect democracy overnight, as most of Africa and rest of the world sees every day. It took hundreds of years for the English Parliament to develop, and that, in a sense, you know, Sturgeon and Salmond are these two medieval, you know, monarchs fighting for it. But the point is that the flaws are unraveling people, and they're visible. So you can now go back and rebuild. And I'm sure you know.
You can, Maggie. If the SNP has an overall majority and Nicola Sturgeon is the first minister, I think that's highly unlikely to happen. I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right that to raise the positive thought, there's always a temptation for me as a Scot to sort of view the glasses half empty. Maybe this is just part of an iterative process. This is how history and constitutional development works. I hope so. But if that is the case, what's needed, and unionists need to be really sensitive to this, because this is not, I don't even think it's a question of being a unionist, being a nationalist, being a devolutionist. The institution exists. Make it function in a way, or give it the powers that means, and it's nothing to do with giving it extra tax powers or borrowing or any of that stuff, the stuff that the nationalists would want, or people who want Devo Max would want. This is about the fundamentals of improving the democracy. The fascinating thing, I think, is that Salmond realizes this. Now, cynics will say, well, he would, but when he put it really pretty well in terms of what the risks are. And if, without getting into the specifics of the allegations, but if the system, the executive, the state, via the Crown Office, various other institutions of the state, the civil service, whether there was an organised plot or whether there was a, which is denied, whether there was a series of cock-ups and then cover-ups, whatever it was, his liberty was on the line. He was then acquitted. If the state, the nascent Scottish state, can do that to the former First Minister of Scotland, to Alex Salmond, the former leader of the SNP, it can do it to anyone. And you are then, you have to think of that, I think, it's a growing up moment, you have to think of that properly, calmly, in terms of potential tyranny. You do have to go back to those sort of 17th and 18th century notions and grapple with it and understand what that means and come up with, and this is where unionists and nationalists who get this, some of them do, you have to be prepared to come up with a reform package, which, I mean, I should write about this for the site at some point, but that is strengthening the powers of the Parliament, strengthening the powers of Scottish local government, separation of powers, breaking up with the Crown Office, changing the role of the Lord Advocate if necessary, open to all manner of other ideas. But I think that that's what needs to come out of this.
How would that actually work? Would that all have to come out of Westminster? Would that be for Westminster to draw up a new Scottish Parliament Part 2? And then,
so,
because how would this, you would need the agreement, presumably, of Holyrood.
How would it happen? There's an obvious, you've hit upon, Maggie, the big complication, which is that Westminster remains sovereign. This is it's a union settlement. I wouldn't propose to change that, though, of course, the Scottish Parliament declares itself sovereign. But there's a potential dispute there. And the danger is that if Westminster is arrogant or presumptuous about it, and Westminster's hardly covered itself in glory in the last couple of years in terms of how the executive has behaved, then the danger is that the nationalists, who are many of those around Sturgeon, are prepared to behave in a very Trumpian, tribal way. If you give them the excuse to say that this is Westminster trying to do in the Scottish Parliament or do it down or take back control, then you won't get very far with the reform programme. I think it will require, if you get a minority government next time, it will require a cross-party effort in Scotland. It will require probably the advice of a decent judge or two, some big figures, experienced figures, cross-party. I mean, there was an attempt to do this a couple of years after the Parliament initially got into trouble in sort of the early 2000s, and David Steele proposed, and was mocked at the time, proposed switching to a second chamber, which I thought was a very good idea because it's a unicameral system. And he suggested, look, actually, people said, oh, that'll just mean more politicians. But there's a way you could have divided the 129 MSPs and had a smaller second chamber, some sort of revising function, and he envisaged stronger committees. That didn't get very far then, but maybe it was too early after devolution. So it has to be done, I think, very sensitively and not in a spirit of Westminster trying to teach Holyrood a lesson. I think that would be fatal. I don't mean in terms of the future of the union or independence. Park that for a moment, just in terms of basic democratic accountability and improvement. So it'll be fascinating to see if some voices emerge at Westminster prepared to engage with this. And I mean, nothing can happen realistically before this side of the election, which is just going to be a mad scramble by the unionist parties to try and deny the SNP a majority. But afterwards, you would hope that a conversation can begin about improvement.
Absolutely, but also, I mean, this whole thing highlights, and I know we can sort of go on about Scotland until the cows come home, so apologies to listeners, but you know, before we move on to the talking a bit about the budget, I'll just say it's very interesting. You know, it's not just about personalities, this 2014 independence referendum may well, I mean, to the English observer, be just another chapter in a story of the SNP regrouping and moving up towards independence. That's how it feels sometimes, looking at the political atmosphere. It's not quite true. 2014 was a major crisis for the SNP. One, they lost. Two, it sort of started to clarify a tension that has long existed in the SNP between the sort of gradualists who advocate the thing I described earlier, new unions for old, who will proudly talk about Scotland as an independent state, keeping the monarchy, for example, keeping the Bank of England, which is in some ways what the whole case for independence founded on in 2014. You know, what's the point of independence and all this harm if you're not really changing much? You know, what's the point of having a social union instead of a united kingdom? And I think it really founded on that point. And that's not to say, and weirdly, unionists have actually begun to embrace that view in a funny way. They, you know, talk about strengthening devolution to the point that we might see Scotland as a federal, as part of a broader federal state, for example. But the point is, nationalism is in crisis because you've got Nicola Sturgeon on the other hand, who has begun to attach it onto a kind of vision of Europe, which no longer seems, you know, a sort of post-sovereign Europe in which Scotland would magically be able to influence things. I mean, let's be honest, that's a naive view of where Europe is headed in lots of ways. And two, it's the social justice agenda to some extent, I think, and Sturgeon has clearly embraced that in a variety of ways, which, you know, rubs up against the, maybe the values of the old guard, people like Jim Sillars or someone like Salmond, in a political way. Probably but don't have time for it.
Yeah. No, but interestingly, Alistair, yes, and I'd echo your apology to listeners who've had enough of Scotland. I mean, we have a bit of a Scotland bias, don't we, on mm-hmm. on reaction. There are too many of us jocks. But some of my English friends just don't care. I mean, that's fine. If you don't want the UK to exist, and you don't want sort of the UK to play a major part internationally, there's an argument for that. England will be absolutely fine. It's an ancient political culture and very, very sophisticated place that is developing more coherent sense of itself, which is the other side of the story, you know, since the 80s and 90s. I think, though, remember, Salmond and Sturgeon were partners in this, when you describe gradualism and fundamentalism. Ironically, Salmond is now surrounded by people who he was at odds with in the 90s. So he was the gradualist, and his theory kind of won out, which was, a lot of nationalists in the 90s were suspicious of the Scottish Parliament because they said this is a Labour plot to kill the SNP. And what that means is that the SNP were until quite late in the process, didn't actually even join in with trying to design the Parliament. Salmond convinced them to go along with it on the basis that it would be a stepping stone to independence, and at the very least would get the SNP into power, and he's been vindicated in that analysis. And the small group of modernisers around him, the gradualists, like Mike Russell, who was his chief executive, young Duncan Hamilton, now a lawyer and now featuring in very prominently in the Sturgeon case, and a handful of others, and among them Nicola, always the one, picked out by Salmond and Russell as, literally I remember them describing to me, as the one. The future leader post Salmond. I remember Salmond describing her as the first woman to lead an independent Scotland after he assumed that he would lead Scotland there. Salmond is now, all of that's blown apart, and Salmond is now actually, quite a lot of his allies are people you would have thought of as what were termed fundamentalists in the 1990s. So you're absolutely right, Alistair, to detect this split and realignment. The other reason the SNP have to hold on to Sturgeon, who is a remarkable politician, is that they don't really have in the wings, a bit like what New Labour did, they don't really have a next generation of leaders. There isn't, I mean, I know there are a couple of potentially interesting younger MSPs, but not really for national leadership, and there aren't that many of them. So if she goes, with her, does the cult of personality take the nationalists down with it? Don't know. But it's so connected, I think, to the former Labour cabinet minister was describing it to me the other day as it's part of that story about politics becoming increasingly about identity. So, and it's that's true with Trump, and that's true with Brexit, and that's true in Scotland now. So that's a world in which it doesn't matter that Donald Trump says lots of rude things. His tribe identifies with him. It doesn't matter that the SNP has an appalling record on education and on health and on the economy and on just about everything, and has been in power for a long time and hasn't utilised the powers that it has in terms of the economy, health and education. and has a dreadful record. To the tribe, that doesn't matter. The danger in all of this is that you just end up with politics, which is just two sides waving flags at each other. And it's then politics becomes about convincing the 10 or 20% in the middle which tribe they feel most comfortable with, which is why unionists, I think, have to be really, really careful in how they handle this. If they just do a rah-rah, the SNP are terrible, and wave the union flag, which I love, but you're trying to persuade people whose primary loyalty is sort of Scottish first and British distant second, that the union is worth something, and that union values improving the Scottish Parliament. Is quite a difficult shift, I think, for a lot of unionists. Maggie, you were going to ask a question.
Yeah, I was going to make an observation and then two questions. One, in a sense, the fact that there is no obvious successor or even movement below Sturgeon, does that suggest in a way she's wearing a hollow crown? Because independence was be an end all, but there's no political philosophy there really underneath, which is why people don't care about the schools, the health, because that's not what they're interested in. They just, you know, had this mad dream of independence. So if you sort of take that away, what's left? And maybe that's why the younger generation are not coming up with their own ideas and why it's all cracking up. So that was sort of just, I suppose that's a question. And secondly, if you were Boris and the cabinet, the government, how best would you handle this now? Because obviously it's sort of a great moment to try and show the strength of the union as SNP is falling apart.
They have to be very careful and have to calibrate their response in a really sensitive way. I know that's, you know, but Boris is just, we've discussed it before, Boris is just, for the overwhelming majority of Scots, is just a non-starter. It's the cultural baggage, the way that he talks, the way that he looks. That's not fair, but life isn't fair and politics is, you know, least fair of all. So they have to, I think they have to do show not tell. They've been, I think, a lot better of late, particularly with the vaccine task force, which is the best thing which has happened for the union. It's the best thing that's happened to the country, and it's the best thing that's happened to tens of millions of people who've got the vaccine. But the notion of a strong UK being fleet of foot and getting early vaccines and that having an impact is obviously a positive story for the union. But I think they've been quite clever so far in just operating on a show-not-tell basis. Boris went to Scotland to one of the factories that they've invested in, Livingston. Wow. And they're just trying to let it speak for itself, which I think is quite a clever way to do it. On the young stuff, I mean, you look at the opinion polling, Alistair will have a better view than me on this, but for large numbers of young Scots, seems about 70%. It's just the idea of Scottish independence or some new kind of setup around the Scottish Parliament just seems to be the natural view. Whether that is a youthful view, which will change in time, I don't know. But I think for a lot of those people, I recognise this as a unionist, a lot of them just see Nicola Sturgeon, someone they identify with, a strong Scottish personality, up against Boris Johnson, someone who just feels alien to them. And then I think there's this terrible thing which unionists are stuck with, to which there isn't really an answer, which is that you turn on the national news in Scotland, 6 o'clock news, we've talked about it before, and it's a parade of Westminster politicians talking, being kicked up and down the park, whether it's Priti Patel or all manner of failings of the UK government highlighted, and as it should be. And there's a very robust national reporting which Scots tune into. And then you tune into the BBC Scotland news. It's not all terrible, but it's pretty pretty light in terms of its scrutiny. Plus, she has an hour of BBC time during the pandemic. That's bound to have an impact. Do you agree, Alistair, or is it lost for your generation of Scots who are in Scotland, or is it salvageable?
Well, you're right. It's pretty bleak in terms of. Yeah, it does feel like the demographics long term point towards Scotland. I've always thought Scotland will become independent in my lifetime. Whether that is, you know, just a maybe over pessimistic or actually naive about the kind of how nothing is really inevitable in politics, I'm not sure. I think unionists do have to unionists have to very much understand, which I'm sure they do, that. Britishness and the Union have at times been sorts of different things. The high point of Britishness only comes into being in the 20th century as a result of the world wars, the BBC, the NHS. This was not a political reality that was just a geographical fact. It didn't just happen. It developed for specific reasons. And then has, to some extent, unravelled. I think with the nationalists, the problem for them, the very deep problem, which is the one I talked about earlier, is they founder on the currency to a large extent still, because they, and these are fundamental questions, you know, Europe, you cannot have this idea that nationalism will be based on a bland Scotland in Europe intellectualism, where Scotland would take its place as a member state within Europe. It is just not, it's very naive about where Europe is going and about security and all kinds of problems about NATO, about how the whole thing is operating. And I just don't see, you know, maybe that's just my view and there's better arguments for it, but I just don't see how the nationalist case has evolved from what it was maybe in the noughties. In terms of that naivety about Europe. And it's still a major problem. What do you do with your currency? What do you do with, you know, in many ways, throughout this crisis, the British government has been able to do lots of things because it's got its own currency. Yeah. It's been able to support the economy in ways that in Europe, a lot of these states simply haven't been able to do. You know, these are fundamental questions which haven't gone away, even in an era of identity politics. Mm.
It's a problem for unionists because, you know, I can say, as I did a few minutes ago, you know, have to talk about this in quite a sensitive fashion. You need to respect the notion of the Scottish Parliament. It's not going to be abolished. It needs to be improved. And you have to, you know, too much emphasis on what nationalists used to call kind of project fear. Fine. But then there's this contradiction, which, as you say, Alistair, the fundamentals are so nuts on this. I mean, it's just, but you can't really have this debate and then not at some point say, right, so you want to leave the UK. This is something much, much bigger than Brexit. This is a 300-year union, a completely integrated single market functioning as one economy with a pensions and welfare system that's integrated and a taxation system that's integrated with a, with armed forces which are integrated, security and intelligence shared capacity, and then not say what money is all this going to happen in. I mean, it's not a rude question, but it's treated by nationalists because there isn't an answer. Several moderate nationalists have tried, and now some complete maniacs are trying with some really mad ideas about how to invent new currencies, with fantastical ideas about what the European Union will allow. But this is that has to count at some point, doesn't it? What money will the pensions be in? What how will the trade function? If you want to leave the UK Union, and there is a border between the EU and the UK, then there will be a border between Scotland and England. It's not rude to ask for an answer, to which the nationalist answer is, and this is where, and I say this as a Brexiteer, this is where there are parallels, having been through the Brexit experience, as a moderate Brexiteer, is that they obviously don't want to answer those questions because there aren't necessarily answers to it. So it's an answer that's similar to the one given by my side in the run-up to the referendum on Brexit, which is stop running us down, we'll sort it out later, which is an approach which has been of limited success so far with Brexit. I think it's fair to say that, isn't it? And this is even bigger. This is money, pensions, welfare, not a European single market, but a proper integrated single market where most Scottish trade overwhelmingly goes.
And actually, again, it's beyond the economic argument. It's social. Families married into each other for generations, work together. Those points, Ian, isn't that precisely why the independence movement didn't win at the last referendum and probably won't again? Because people might have this wonderful, you know, dream about independence, but in their hearts they know that it's a fairly crazy thing to rip apart.
I think I'm thinking of nationalist friends hearing it described like that. How I would characterise it? Yeah, I mean, I think I think Scotland would be fine eventually, because it's an industrious place with lots of bright people and a lot going for it. I think it lacks depth of wealth, unlike some of the Scandinavian countries to which it's compared. I think that's a problem. And I think the relationship with the English would be really difficult. I think a lot of people who advocate Scottish independence don't understand how the English would behave. But it's probably about 40 to 45%, Maggie, who just make the assumption that it's whether fervently, which is probably about a third, and then on top of that, people just make the assumption that we'd just be better doing our own thing and sort of getting out there and we'll sort it out as we go. And it's just an assumption. And then it seems about 40% on the other side are union at all costs. And then in the middle are a lot of people who are a nationalist term, indie curious, interested, culturally attracted to the idea, but worried about the economic realities. So it will come. That's what 2014 came down to. And if it comes to a referendum, which is no guarantee it will, but if it does come to a referendum in the next 10 years, it'll be the battle over that 10% middle ground. Very often, you know, Scottish professionals or white collar Scots nervous about pensions, nervous about trade, and the practicalities, while thinking that the idea has a certain attractiveness. Do we want to talk about the budget? There'll be some listeners thinking, can we not talk about Scotland and now talk about this massive, I was going to say massive economic event. It wasn't in the end. It was all so far, you know, trailed that the speech itself was, you felt like you knew most of it. We're on slightly different sides on this, weren't we, Maggie? You had maybe a more balanced view of it than me. I just didn't like it. I have a tendency to not like budgets, and particularly ones that are concocted in a kind of Instagram friendly way, in the way that the Rishi Sunak does it. But I just didn't like the tax stuff, and I just think it's I'm on the side where, you know, ironically, I would have been for public for spending restraint in 2010, 2011, 2012. To me now, it's just anything we do which infringes on the recovery or threatens the recovery, which we desperately need as soon as we're all allowed to start functioning properly again, hopefully in May/June. I just think he's taken, I think he's made a policy error, but you took a slightly different view.
No, maybe I didn't say it. I thought the corporation tax was completely bonkers and the wrong thing to do, as we've discussed many times. But my my question was that actually he's got a get out, that if the recovery bounces back, they'll drop it. I mean, that was sort of my only point. No, look, I would.
But just on that, Maggie, I thought this was what I thought the trick that he missed, because he did introduce this investment, you know, this super deduction thing, which some people are actually criticizing. And I see Paul Johnson of the IFS. If people are wondering what the super deduction is, it's essentially a tax break subsidy designed to encourage British business to invest in plants and machinery. So this is, you know, rather than, you know, recycling reallocating the money in share buybacks and all the rest of it, actually invest in plant and machinery, and with the view that this will increase productivity, which is the thing which has bedeviled the UK economy for some time. So that's the theory. But he could have said, as a senior Tory said to me, he could have said, look, because we've cut corporation tax, and they have done, it's been a big part of the Tory policy since Osborne and Cameron. But then it's not, and it hasn't boosted business investment in the way that they anticipated. So they could say, look, we're at a point here where in a couple of years' time, there may be stresses and strains on the public finances. We're giving now this tax break, invest. And if you don't invest, then in plants and machinery and take advantage of these and really go for it on that front, then I retain the option on increasing capital gains tax and corporation tax in a couple of years' time. Do you see what I mean, Maggie? That there's sort of carrot and stick. Instead, now everyone's thinking, well, 19% to 25% in one go. I mean, that's massive.
No, I think it's absolutely not only the wrong message, but actually is not very effective, because all the numbers show, and if you compare us with any European country, the lower your corporation tax, the higher your tax takers, your tax revenues. And I think I quoted, was it Doug McWilliams, that total in 2019, 8% of all tax revenues came from corporation tax, and we're at 19%. In France and Germany, only 4% and 5% come from corporation tax. And we've seen it go up since Osborne's days. You know, it works. And the other thing is, I just can't bear chancellors who fiddle. So this really ridiculous idea that if your profits are under 50,000, right? He didn't say whether operating profits, pre-tax profits.
Yep.
You continue at the 19% and then it would be graded. Well, you know what's going to happen, don't you?
Yeah.
Companies are going to find all sorts of ways to, at the marginal level to show a smaller profit.
Yes.
I just
You've created an incentive for companies not to grow and become more profitable.
And another loophole.
Which is a completely mad idea. I mean, I've just got a question for both of you. But just first, just be a grumpy old man about it, is that I also really hate the way, and some people say it started under Gordon Brown and has developed ever since, but I hate the way in which they're not serious economic events now. Yeah. And if you compare it with the economic analysis that went with the Lawson budget, whether you agree with it or not, the scale of what he's sort of talking about in terms of discussing the money supply and how the economy works, and in the context of the global economy, international trade, huge developments. So you felt with Lawson, you felt this, and Ken Clark to a lesser extent, but certainly with Lawson, you felt this remarkable political and economic intelligence being applied to big, serious questions. Now it's just sort of leaked out a week in advance. It's a series of kind of show pony announcements, and then the speech itself is, you know most of it, and it's pretty dull. Then with one rabbit, and then it's all the economics is contracted out to the OBR, Office of Budget Responsibility, and then the IFS weighs in, and that it just seems to me fundamentally unserious compared to.
I agree.
30 years ago, but then maybe that's just how life works, that you think everything, as you get older, everything was more serious and impressive 30 years ago, which obviously it wasn't.
No, I'm with you. I can be a grumpy old woman as well. I mean, as I said yesterday, thank God for sturgeons. I just didn't listen to it soon. It's the gimmick.
As you said in your reaction evening briefing. It was the first budget you've ever just thought, I don't really need to listen to that, and I'll tune into something else instead, which is Sturgeon, which is much more interesting. Just the question I had, which I'll put to Alistair first, is because it's obviously the economics, I don't think, is particularly serious, but the politics of it is interesting in that it's the Tories shape-shifting again, as they do throughout their history, and repositioning themselves this time as a sort of high spending, higher tax party. Is that, though, is it possibly, or am I giving him too much credit, Alistair? Do you think this is him realizing that, just like the 2008 crisis was a big shift in politics, I mean, look what follows from 2008 in terms of the war on the elites, arguments about austerity, development of the new left, both in the US and in the UK, leads to riots in it, or leads to demonstrations, and then ultimately Corbynism, arguably. So it shakes politics. 2008. Is his calculation that the pandemic is going to do something similar, and is he's going to make people more demanding of government and more interested in paternalism? So accept that and fill that space first before Labour can. Is that what he's up to?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, it's part of the kind of broader reasoning about it. I mean, the something we've talked about before, I think, on this podcast is, you know, then the question is, you know, doesn't it just allow Starmer to sort of, you know, people may to just, it's territory that Starmer likes, so Starmer will be able to sort of frame the debates within the orthodoxy set by the Tories and sort of make the case better back at people. So yeah, but it's an interesting point though about how politics sort of develops, and especially that point about the new left is an interesting one, because again, I don't really have a firm view on this, but the politics of austerity weirdly hasn't damaged the Tories in electoral terms, apart from in 2017 to some extent. And 2017, you could argue, was about Theresa May. But it's really extraordinary that this historic, in many ways, you know, you can point to literally, I mean, concrete things that the austerity project, you know, things that didn't work, you know, trying to reform the whole of the welfare, you know, welfare at the same time created, you know, perverse incentives. It was very lumpy for a long time. I mean, now people talk about universal credit as a success story after the pandemic, but it wasn't always true, and it took a very long time to work out. But it is fascinating to see, you know, what, you're right, what headwinds are there in the next 10 years for the Tories? They can't keep on increasing their vote share because they have done so. I think it's since 2007 that they've just increased their vote share every single time. So yeah, is this the kind of nimble Tories, you know, shelving orthodoxy to get the next headwind? I don't know. Maybe something will come from kind of a different direction that is kind of unexpected.
I wonder if it might come this time from the centre right. I wonder if it might actually be. I mean, the Tory Party in Parliament, it's very difficult not being there at the moment. Difficult to get a sense of it. But just ringing around a bit last night, and texting people, there was some opposition, but they're not really. As one of them said to me, he didn't think his colleagues, and he had been in the tea room, he didn't think his colleagues had really worked out what it meant. They just thought they were talking in terms of, this really shoots Starmer's fox because it's moving on to Labour territory, which is not the basis on which you should try and run an economy or establish pro-growth policies, which are going to give you, you're supposed to be doing something more than just trying to piss off your opponent. I wonder if it might come out of, hesitate to say think tanks, but sort of but out of something younger and slightly more libertarian. and people becoming more interested in social freedom after the trauma of what's happened in the last year and the way in which the state has accrued so much power, and marrying that to economic freedom.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a profound pushback against things like, there's going to be a profound pushback at a local level against things like low traffic neighbourhoods, for example. Huge issue, yeah. Which is totally embraced by people of a sort of unthinking left liberal outlook as just a good thing, but are being introduced in my views in an undemocratic way, generating huge local antagonism between the rich and the poor.
Yeah.
I think that's actually the terrain, you know, and I've talked about it a lot, and maybe I've over-argued it and gone around in circles a bit, but that, especially in cities, you know, there is a remarkable level of inequality within areas. And this is not good for our social fabric, and it hasn't been good for us for over a decade now. And it is remarkable the degree to which segregation has a basically a definitive role in the structure of our cities. I wonder whether that will certainly play a role in our politics. I think there is, and things like LCNs, where it's clearly one class basically exerting its, you know, ruling in a sense of virtue and saying this is all for the greater good, while it's sort of basically smashing other people. But anyway, I think that's an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah.
Maggie.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say you're so right, Alistair. And it's just the liberal left. I mean, it's very much the Conservative Party and Boris's big greenery and, you know, this paternalistic one nation, cuddly, compassionate, dolphin loving. It's all part of that. So, and the local councils are not even doing their homework on these LTNs. And you probably know my brother took Islington Town Council to court, and he's still pursuing them for judicial review, arguing that they put these LTNs in without the due process that they should, because what they've actually done is stopped precisely hard, you know, the white van driver, he can't deliver, the disabled people can't get dropped off at their home, but, you know, the McKinsey lawyer or McKinsey consultant can cycle in his Lycra to work and feel very, very good. But, you know, how do you, it's a bit like Scotland, how do you fight? The council, of course, is just completely closed ranks. But, you know, they have every weekend their sort of mini riots around Hackney against all these things. But, you know, do we see a sort of political movement in this? I mean, I'd love to think.
Well, it's definitely a gilets jaunes type thing.
That's funny you should say that, Alistair. I was just thinking exactly that. Isn't there now the possibility, and I mean, on the green stuff, I'm pretty agnostic. I'm kind of in the Bjorn Lomborg school of it's happening, and put most of your efforts into adaptation and innovation and try and deal with the specific problems. But the government is embarked on it's happening, it's unstoppable because of Boris's view, Biden's view, the consensus in business, consensus increasingly in the city as well, that it's just this green revolution thing is coming down the track. It's the story of the next 10 years, which maybe it will be, and maybe all that will happen smoothly. But there is another possibility, which is what you've just described, Maggie, fusing with that latent energy of UKIP-y Britain, which doesn't now really have a cause. It's embedded at the moment within the Boris movement and accounts for the fact that he's at 43, 44% in the polls. But let's try and imagine a situation in a couple of years' time in which the green stuff is really, in which energy costs are rising and in which this stuff, I mean, people are in favour of it at the moment. I mean, so much money is being made by pollsters telling government what they want to hear, and that other people are very much in favour of other people paying much higher taxes. Shock. And on the green stuff, there's been polling showing that it's actually popular in the red wall and all the rest of it. maybe I'm being too cynical. Maybe that'll hold, and maybe that'll grow. But when bills go up and some of this stuff starts to happen, are we absolutely sure?
Yeah, that people will start objecting. I mean, yeah, and you know, you can see polling. If you ask somebody a question, would you like to live in a lovely, clean air environment, you know, in all very green, you're not going to say no, are you? No, actually, I love inhaling sulfurous carbon dioxide from cars. But if you want to say to people, you know, do you want to get to your business quickly, they're going to say yes. And also, I think people confuse green with conservation. Conservation is a great thing, but you know, the schemes and the money that's being made out of a lot of these, well, it's another subject, wind turbines and so forth, all subsidized. Anyway, that's another
subject. I'm not, you know, so I'm sounding like a complete skeptic on this. I'm not. I cleaner cities, a lot of this stuff that we've been doing that we can now, you know, do in a different way, fantastic. But just flagging up whether in the next 2-3 years. That's the tension point. If you're looking for where has the attack come on Boris, I'd say the political risk for him is fairly high. Is look at these very comfortable London people with their nice houses and their kind of Greenpeace agenda, whacking up bills. I think that could be a problem. Should we talk about briefly just about Harry and Meghan? And Alistair, I think you said it's on Monday. It's on Monday in the UK. It's on Sunday in the US, and we will have a report on the site overnight for those who are interested. And let's face it, there'll be people listening to this trying to pretend that they're not interested, but they are interested because it's just an extraordinary story. Maggie, what's your take? And how does he get himself into the position where he's kind of not a war with the Queen, but he's in a situation where the Queen's husband is in a fairly serious situation in hospital, being treated for a heart complaint. He's 99 in the middle of a global pandemic. Very difficult time for the Queen, and Harry ends up on television with Oprah Winfrey, with his wife describing the monarchy as the firm, which I don't think she means it in the polite way that that the Duke of, or amusing way that the Duke of Edinburgh does, means the firm in America has kind of organized crime.
I think it's Don Corleone.
Well, it's more that sort of Tom Cruise movie, The Firm. I mean, that's a pretty extraordinary thing to say about your mother-in-law.
Yeah, it's really difficult to try and even think to get inside his head, isn't it? And what he's playing at. Do you think he's just now so far away, so caught up with that whole, you know, feely, touchy Hollywood thing that he's just sort of, maybe he's loving it. You know, I tell you what I do think, is if they'd gone off and become hippies living up in the mountains somewhere and in a wigwam, you'd really respect it. That would be leaving the firm, wouldn't it? Grow your own sedge. Get some alpaca, you know, and you know, smoke some weed and just, you know, crash out. Then you'd really respect him. You would respect him.
Retreat, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Retreat to Mount Carmel. There's a very intriguing, there's a very interesting part of the, infamous James Corden, Harry interview. My attitude towards the royals is, I always say, I don't care at all, and I think it's all, you know, not something even to think about until I see that long read in the Sunday Times about the latest thing, and suddenly I'm like, oh, of course I'm going to read it and sort of get interested. there's a bit in that James Corden interview, it was a sort of bizarre 15 minutes where he gallivanted around LA and went to see the house where the Prince of Bel-Air was shot and went inside. And there's a really interesting bit where he says, James Corden goes, oh no, what about COVID, to Harry? And Harry puts on a mask, sort of, you know, as if it's just, you know, something you should do. But then says, and goes inside, and Corden goes, no, stop, what are you thinking? And then Harry goes, oh, I've had a test. And just merrily goes in, there are people in there. And I just think, in LA, at the point at which that interview was shot, schools are still shut, and they have been for months and months. It's having California has had has had very long lockdowns, proportionally some of the most strictest lockdowns in the whole of the US, and has had a very, very bad experience with coronavirus, even has its own homegrown variant, you know, more transmissible variant like our own. You know, let's not just think about the British context. This is also in a state which is really suffering.
Yeah.
And this prince or duke, whatever, says, I can just ignore it, kind of, because I've had a test, probably got it this morning before I went on the telly. It just, he is thick privileged and is exercising his privilege in order to gain more attention. He is an upper class twit, and people don't see it in those terms because they see Harry in America, of course they see it in terms of race to some extent. They see the firm as closed ranks and as basically attempted to go out and destroy the reputation of someone who's black and from America, and Harry is bound up with that, and you know, okay, you know, that's the view in America, but you know, we're not in America here, and you see it in different ways. And I just don't understand why people don't wake up to the fact that these are two people from the sort of dominant entertainment class, a marriage of hereditary privilege and Hollywood's royalty or entertainment royalty, basically having their chips, and we have to watch.
I do think, actually, I mean, I don't really give a toss what they do, and if people want to read it, I don't think it's a crisis for the monarchy at all. I think we all think it's a great fun sideshow, although I think there's a very deep point about, I don't think Meghan was badly treated here. I really don't, and I think she has probably more than keep, you know, she can throw her own, I think, keep her own. But what I do think is that he should. I think he should have his successor.
Sorry, Maggie, I interrupted you. Go.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say.
Which is it's interesting you raise that, because lots of people are in favour of that.
Yeah.
Which just to me is the tragic thing about it. I mean, you described him in pretty blunt terms, Alistair, but then the flip side of that is that he was very popular before all of this. Mm. And why was he popular? He was popular because of what happened to his mother with the tabloid press, and he was lost his mother very young, and then he served his country doing something very dangerous, flying Apaches. And, you know, service is universal and all that crap, as Meghan says, like some sort of Californian self-help book, help book. Well, he did actually do it. You know, he did serve. He served his country. He just seems to have squandered all of that. It's incredibly sad. Yeah, but also, who is it that said it's just... I don't think it is. And there will be people listening to this who tell me that I'm wrong. And... that to me the race thing does not feature at all. I don't think it's a factor. It's just she's from the entertainment industry and she's American, and I love America, but America and royalty, America and British royalty, just doesn't mix, as we first discovered in the 1930s, because the obligations and duty and audience is by definition different. Her duty and her obligation is to her career and her personal fame and expanding it, which she's managed to cloak in a whole load of kind of new age crap. But still, that's what it is. She is in the entertainment business. And a royal has a different set of obligations and different duties and responsibilities. And the two just don't mix very well, which she either doesn't want to hear or doesn't understand. But anyway, so we're going to see on Sunday/Monday, and there will be a report written by one of our best writers up on Monday morning for all of you who are pretending that you're not interested in Harry and Meghan.
It's going to be so painful. It's going to be so painful.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it. I'm just going to watch the highlights.
Yeah, it's the way her doe eyes looking up at him and her cradling her stomach. You just it's so
yes.
Hate.
So I think we should wrap things up there. We have massively overrun and didn't notice actually because it was so interesting talking. Good to be back with the Reaction podcast. If you're not a Reaction subscriber, it's really straightforward. You go to the website, you get my weekly newsletter, you get all the brilliant journalism from Maggie, Alistair and the team, an evening email, and you get invites to our subscriber-only events, which are on Zoom, with all sorts of great guests. And that, of course, we'll go back to live events, which I think is going to happen sooner than people think. I think the world will start to come back. But until the next episode of the Reaction Podcast, thank you very much for listening.